Please open in your Bibles to Esther chapter 1. And if you stand, I'll be reading verses 1 through 22. Esther chapter 1, verses 1 through 22, as we look at the fateful banquet of King Ahasuerus and really set up the rest of the narrative, the rest of the fascinating story of what goes on in the book of Esther. So listen carefully to see what King Ahasuerus is like and to see how the author portrays him and what happens to him in this first chapter. Esther chapter 1, beginning in verse 1. Now it took place in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was at the citadel in Susa, in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes in attendance, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. And he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. When these days were completed, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days for all the people who were present at the citadel in Susa, from the greatest to the least, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were hangings of fine white and violet linen held by cords of fine purple linen on silver rings and marble columns, and couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels of various kinds, and the royal wine was plentiful according to the king's bounty. The drinking was done according to the law. There was no compulsion, for so the king had given orders to each official of his household that he should do according to the desires of each person. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abgatha, Zethar, and Carcass, the 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of a King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. Then the king became very angry, and his wrath burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for it was the custom of the king so to speak before all who knew the law and justice and were close to him, Karshena, Shether, Admatha, Tarshish, Marish, Marsena, and Memucan, the 7 princes of Persia and Media, who had access to the king's presence and sat in the first place in the kingdom. According to law, what is to be done with Queen Vashti, because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? In the presence of the king and the princes, Memucan said, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also all the princes and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought into his presence, but she did not come. This day the ladies of Persia and Media, who have heard of the queen's conduct, will speak in the same way to all the king's princes, and there will be plenty of contempt and anger. If it pleases the king, let a royal edict be issued by him, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti may no longer come into the presence of King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. When the king's edict, which he will make, is heard throughout all his kingdom, great as it is, then all the women will give honor to their husbands, great and small. This word pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. So he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province according to its script, and to every people according to their language, that every man should be the master in his own house and the one who speaks in the language of his own people. Please be seated. So this week, I spent time all week with about 35 teens and leaders, and we were here at the church for our every 2 years, we do an in-town mission trip. We call it Evangelism Implosion, and this week it was the G4M, the Gospel for Maribel. In the morning, we studied world religions and received instructions on evangelism. Then in the afternoon, we went door-to-door witnessing, sharing the good news of Jesus Christ on the doorsteps and porches of houses within a 2-mile radius of the church. In the evening, we spent time then in worship, and Tyler Vanderhoeven taught us how to develop biblical boldness. Now, this year, we used a little bit of a different method. Oftentimes, past years, we've just gone with our Bible track, the Biblical Salvation Explained, gone to the doorstep, said, we're sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ. Can I share this track with you? And then got the yes or no answer and, you know, tried to share and moved on. Well, this year I decided to do a survey. Now, I haven't done that before because sometimes I've seen surveys used and it's just if people feel like they're being suckered into something, a survey, and then all of a sudden you're sharing the gospel with them and they're like, wait a minute, I thought this was a survey. So we solved that problem this way. We said, we would like to share, or would like to go through a survey about the gospel of Jesus Christ. Because see, when someone walks away from the door, if someone says, I don't want to hear that, I don't want it to be that they didn't hear a religious survey or they didn't want to talk to someone from Grace Community Church, because that doesn't matter. And I don't want them to be in heaven to be able to say, hey, nobody ever came and tried to share the gospel with me. I want it to be known when we stand on a doorstep that we are sharing the gospel. And the survey was all about the gospel. The questions that we designed were this. I'm going to read them to you because it might be even a way for you to walk through gospel conversation. But we had 8 questions, and the first one was, do you believe in a God who created the universe? If they say no, then we say, well, how did the universe come into existence? And so you have a great conversation right there. If they say yes, then you say, well, how would you describe the God who created the universe? And as they speak about that, you can just fill in, the kids could just fill in the blanks. If so, they said, God's all powerful. Yes, and the Bible says he's also holy and just, and he's a loving God. Then you move on to the next question. Do you believe that there is an absolute standard of right and wrong? So if people say no, and several did, certainly, you say, well, what is the source, or how do you determine what is right and wrong? And that's a great conversation. If there is no absolute standard, then how do you determine that? I had several fascinating conversations with people who were sure there wasn't an absolute standard, and I'd be like, well, if there's no absolute standard, then I can just decide what I want to do to you. They're like, well, yeah, but I say, well, what if I want to harm you? Well, no, right? So you have a great conversation. If they say yes, though, you say, well, what is that absolute standard, and how has it been revealed to us? How do we know what that standard is? You can say, well, the Bible reveals the absolute standard of God. Question 3, do you believe that all people sin, that is, do wrong things which violate God's law? If they say no, which I don't think anyone said nobody sins, then you could say, what are the source of wrong things in the world? If nobody sins, where do all the wrong things come from? I didn't get to bust that question out because nobody said that nobody sins, right? But if they say then people do sin, here's the question we would ask, what sort of penalty should people pay for violating God's law? Should there be a penalty for that? And you'd be amazed how many people said, well, yeah, but actually what they always said was, but there's forgiveness. See, they knew that there ought to be a penalty, but they didn't want to talk about it. They just wanted to say there's forgiveness. Then you talk, how do you get forgiveness? And forgiven from what? Anyway, great opportunities to launch into the gospel. And if they, then you just quote Romans 3:23, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Then question 4, do you believe you are a good person? Now, actually, we did have someone say no to this. We got back about 180 surveys, but that person was a believer. We're like, no, because I need Christ for my righteousness. Oh, every other time we got, yes, I'm a good person. Now, many of those people were actually believers, but when you say good person, they just automatically think it's because I do good stuff. And then you ask them these questions. Have you lied? Have you looked with lust? Have you committed murder in your heart by being angry? And then, oh, yeah, I've done that. And then you say, well, what the Bible says is that there's none good. No, not one. None who seeks after God. There is none righteous. And what that means is that there's no one who is capable of meriting God's salvation. That's what we mean. Then you go on to question number 5. Do you believe in a real heaven and real hell? And people say, if not, then what do you believe happens to people when they die? And that's a great conversation. And I had several people say, there's no heaven, there's no hell. I said, well, then what happens? Well, we just go back to dust. And then you can go on. The Bible says in Hebrews 9:27, it is appointed for men to die once. And after this comes judgment. There is something that happens. If they say there is a real heaven and a real hell, you say, well, who goes to heaven and who goes to hell? I'd be amazed at the answers I got back on that one. What does the Bible say? Who goes? Who doesn't? Next question was, do you personally attend a church? And amazing, people would say, yes, I believe in a God. Yes, there's an absolute standard. Yes, people violate the standard. Yes, people are going to hell. Yes, there's a heaven. And then I said, you go to church. And they go, no. I'm like, well, why not? Well, you know, I used to go, and they would just maybe share a bad experience, or I just haven't had time to find one. They've been here for, you know, how long have you been here? 10 years? Long, long look. Now, again, it's hard to find a good church. I get that, but it's a long time. So then I would say, well, let's consider it this way. And again, the kids had various responses to this. So they would, and sometimes they would just move on, and kind of depending on their level of maturity and ability, they would go further or not. Right? But oftentimes I would say, well, you know, I've been married for 32 years, and if I told my wife that I loved her and that I cared for her and I never came home and I never talked to her, do you think she would believe me? And one guy said, son, I've been married for 49 years. You got nothing on me. I was like, well, if you never went home after 49 years, or, you know, if in 49 years you never went home, then do you think your wife would believe that you loved her if you never said anything to her? And he said, well, no. And it was the same way with the church. These are God's people. 1 John 4:20 says, if you say that you love God and you hate your brother, you don't love his people, then you are a liar. And I'd say that with a smile, and I'd call them a liar with a smile. And, you know, it wouldn't, nobody on that side of things got mad at me there. I say, it's just, it can't be true, because The church is God's people. You don't go to the church to get saved. You don't go to the church because your parents went there. You go because that's where God's people are, and you can worship God, and you can love his people. And if you love God, you love his people. And they'd look real convicted and say, well, I'm looking for a church. Well, we got one for you. And so on our track, it says Grace Community Church. And next question was, do you believe that Jesus was a real person who died on the cross and rose again from the dead? If they said, if not, then we say, well, who do you think Jesus was? I didn't have anybody tell me that they didn't think Jesus lived, except the ones who had already slammed the door by that point. I never got to the point on the survey if I was still there. They'd say, well, we believe Jesus died and rose again. If so, then I would ask, have you trusted in Jesus as your personal Savior? That's next on our survey. Why or why not? And then you could begin to talk about the gospel right there. We had the gospel track with us, and you could hand it to them. All right, if they said no, then you'd say, well, let me tell you the gospel. If they said yes, then we'd often say, then the last question, how would you define the good news about Jesus Christ? So we'd ask them to share the gospel with us. Because it's amazing how many people would get through all those questions, and then you say, well, can you share the good news, which we'd just gone through? And they would say, that's a hard question. Wait a minute, they just claim to be believers, essentially, and you don't know the good news. So, well, then can we share with you this pamphlet, this tract that we have about the good news, which is that God is the creator and owner of everything, that he is perfect and holy and just, and he can have no sin in his presence, and so we must judge sin with a righteous standard, but he's also loving, and he desires to have a relationship with his people. But the problem is that men are sinful. They all come into the world tainted with sin, and they're on their way to eternal hell, and they deserve every ounce of hell that they get, and there's nothing they can do to escape from that. But God in his love sent his son, the Lord Jesus Christ, born of a virgin, to walk upon this earth, fully God and fully man, to live a perfect life, to die on the cross, to take the penalty for sin, to die in the place of sinners, to rise again on the third day so that they might have new life. But you have to respond. You have to repent of sin, recognize you're a sinner, recognize you deserve eternal hell, desire to turn from that sin and place your faith in Christ alone. That is recognizing that he is God and man, that he died for you, that his is the only sacrifice, and that he's your Lord and King. You serve him with your life, and that's the gospel. And so the kids, we were teaching them over and over just to share those things, God, man, Christ, in response, and over and over. Now, I got back about 180 of those surveys in the 3 days we went witnessing, which essentially means that we had almost, and probably had more than that, 180 gospel conversations. That is where we went all the way through the survey, and so we're able to share the gospel in that way. We left tracks either in someone's hand or on our doorstep, about 1,500 doors that we were able to leave tracks at, with about those 180 to 200 gospel conversations, all in 3 days. Then we went on Friday night, and they had a festival here that they do occasionally, and so they block off the streets downtown, and we had a booth where we shared the gospel bracelet. So it's got the gospel written or stated in these colors, and so we had kids sit, and we would share the gospel, and their parents were listening. And then they go over and get face painting, and we do that. And meanwhile, there's people circulating all around through these 4 or 5 blocks here, handing out tracts, and then some who were doing the survey. So we did about another 40 surveys, almost 50 surveys, with people who were walking around downtown. Had some fascinating conversations. The reason I'm wearing this shirt is not because I've decided to stop wearing a tie. I like wearing ties. Well, I don't like it, but I do it. But if you see someone with a shirt on, you ought to ask them, did you share with Christ with someone this week, and what was that like? Because they'll have a story for you. Some were crazy stories with people that said wild things and confronted them about why they were on the doorstep. We got a call here at the church, get your kids off my street. It's not your street, but nonetheless, we don't want this here in Maryville. And yet, that's why we were out. That kind of reaction is really, we don't want to make people mad, but if they're going to get mad about something, we'd rather have it be the gospel and not some foolish thing we've done. So we had them out there. So all together, probably 250 gospel conversations, 2,000 tracts. Not that the numbers in and of themselves are important, but I just want to explain to you what your teens from this church did this week. And it's not impressive or showy. We go around beating drums saying, look how wonderful we are. Look how great Grace Community Church is. And we think we're all great because we're out here evangelizing. No, our focus was on the Lord Jesus. Because it's just got long. The streets got longer and longer. It's 97 degrees on Wednesday. And I'm walking with a group of teens and we're like, we're about to die here, but we're going to the next thing. And people say, man, you're out here. Let me give you some water. You're going to pass out. Yes, there's no show to it. Pounding the pavement, quietly engaging people. Again, we did have some kind of spectacular conversations. Talking with people, and people who were convicted, and people who were wrestling. But most of it was just normal, basic, people rejecting, people talking. And these are the things we do all the time. This is how the kingdom of God advances. Yes, we do a special week to do that, and we have other special times, but these are what our lives are all about. Quietly, carefully, sincerely, lovingly presenting the truth of the gospel. And the reason that I say this in light of the book of Esther is that the book of Esther opens up with a big show. You got a big man, the big man on campus, the big man in the world with a big kingdom and a big banquet, and everything looks impressive. And that's what the world tries to do to you. Say, you got to be impressive. You got to be something. But there's only one person who's something. And that's Jesus, and it's not us. The world tries to impress us with its big show, but it's nothing more than that, just a show. We have to be careful not to get sucked in by what seems to be impressive and powerful, particularly when what Christians have to offer seems so basic, so mundane, downright boring in one sense, and really scandalous. Why would you believe in a king who died, who got killed when he came to this earth, a God who dies? Who would believe in that kind of thing? Much of the Christian life is slow, laborious, often a painful process of pressing on through difficulty, being faithful in the little things so that we might be conformed to the image of Christ and others would see and benefit from that confirmation. This is the way God accomplishes his work in the world. It may look like the world and the flesh and the devil are going to triumph, but they will not. But it won't be because we match the world power for power, show for show, and bring on the lights and get the smoke machine and do the impressive thing. And we have the gospel. That's impressive. That's it. Because there's nothing else impressive about us. What we'll see this morning is that God expects those whom he gives wealth and power to use it for his glory, not their own. And when they refuse to acknowledge him, he brings his judgment. God expects those whom he gives wealth and power to use it for his own glory, not theirs. And when they refuse to acknowledge him, he brings his judgment. Don't be fooled by the wealth and power of the wicked. It is fleeting. It's fleeting. Well, remember where we are. We're studying the book of Esther. We began last week with an overview of the book and looked at the themes of the book. Remember, there are several. There's the historical theme, that is the intent of the author to his historical audience in the 400s BC. It was written to the Jews in exile who did not return to their homeland to demonstrate God's ongoing favor towards them and to provide the foundation for the origin of the feast that they celebrated, the Feast of Purim. Now, the theological, the principal theme is this: God uses ordinary people to accomplish his sovereign purposes and gives them power to be faithful in the face of impossible circumstances. To boil that down even more simply, God sovereignly provides deliverance through faithful people. And then if you want to memorize this theme, which you can, it's great to memorize the themes of books of the Bible so you know where to go to find certain information. Preservation through providence. Preservation through providence. Now, the timing in history, remember, is a time after the Jews have returned from their 70-year captivity in Babylon. Zerubbabel has led the first return back to Jerusalem to rebuild the second temple in 536 BC. Ezra and Nehemiah will soon lead their returns back to the promised land. Ezra in 458 BC and Nehemiah in 445. However, we know, and particularly from this book, that many Jews remain behind in Persia. And so back in Persia, as it were, we have King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, he's called, if you have an NIV, he's ruling Persia. And really, our events here take place from about 486, really 483, because this is the third year of his reign. He began reigning in 486, and he reigned until 465. We get about 10 years of the events of his reign written for us in the book of Esther. And if you want to place this in Bible book context, really what happens in Esther takes place between chapter 6 and chapter 7 of Ezra. So Ezra chapter 6, there's a break. It doesn't look like it from the text, but there's about a 58-year break between Ezra chapter 6 and Ezra chapter 7, and that's where the events of Esther fit in. Well, we've reviewed our history. Also, last week we saw the big picture that we have an historical religion. That is a religion that is based in the true events of history because God is sovereign over all of history. But now it's time to dive into the details of this fascinating narrative, to see the work of God through foolish, evil men and through wise, faithful servants. Today, the action begins with the king's fateful banquet. Let's dive in. First, the king's prestigious identity. You can spell prestigious however you want. The king's prestigious identity. Now, the book opens with a bang. We saw last week, now. Okay, here we go. We just jump right into the action from wherever you were, and I would call you this morning from wherever you were, whatever you've been doing, whatever you've been thinking about, now. Focus. Here we go. This is what's going on. Now, it took place in the days of Ahasuerus. So it just drives us back towards this particular time, to this particular king. So took place in the days. Now it says the Ahasuerus, so it's not just any Ahasuerus as though there were just any. Right? It's the, that is the one who ruled over 127 provinces. We know from last week he is the son of Darius I, perhaps the greatest of all the kings of Persia, who has extended that kingdom from India, the Indus Valley in the middle of the Indian Peninsula, all the way to Ethiopia. It's a massive kingdom. It is the largest kingdom that has existed up to this point in history. That is the point that we're talking about in history. There were bigger kingdoms after that, but this is the biggest kingdom up to that point in history. This Ahasuerus reigned from 486 to 465. He recaptured Egypt. He put down a rebellion in his capital, which is really why we get in year 3, because he spent his first 3 years trying to get everything under control. He had to fight to get the throne as one of the sons. There were two sons who were fighting. He achieves the supremacy. He puts down rebellions in the capital city itself, and then he recaptures a portion of Egypt that had rebelled. Now things are somewhat quiet in his kingdom, and he's got plans. All right, we're not going to see his historical plans in this narrative, but we will see God's plans for him as he tries to walk through his own plans. Now, I would just say this. The king is presented to us in the text, and it's really important to understand this. Hermeneutics of how we study Old Testament books are that we look to see how the author uses words and how he sets up the characters so that he's pointing us to understand something about them. Well, in the first part of this chapter, the author is going out of his way to show us how great Ahasuerus thinks he is. There's all kinds of reversals and irony in the book of Esther, so he's going to bring in the fact that Ahasuerus is not so great. But everything starts with the greatness of this king really thrust into our face by the narrative. He's all these provinces. He rules this. He's got this incredible banquet. The king is a big somebody. But this did not make him a worthy person, nor did it enable him to control his own destiny. See, he thought he could, and the world thinks they can, and they give you this big show, and they say we're all so powerful, but they can't control the smallest of things, as we will see in this text this morning. And they cannot control the hearts of other people. They can't even really control their own hearts. We will see all of that in the text. Doesn't matter how impressive you are. Doesn't matter how big a somebody you are. And I would say this, and also in ours, we work our way through an Old Testament narrative, which we haven't done for a while. Remember, there are three levels of interpretation or three levels of presentation. The first is the meaning to the original audience. We've kind of talked through that in why he wrote it, to tell them about Purim and to let them know that God cares for the audience he was writing to. Then we have principles that apply to us today. They kind of move across the bridge from 400 BC to us, and they're principles that will always be true. Right? So we'll principalize the text. And then there also will be application, things that aren't necessarily the author's primary point, but they get raised in your mind as we go through this. I mean, you're seeing this big, impressive guy, and some things in your mind are like, well, who are we? And are we supposed to be? There's all kinds of thoughts. We're going to look at how a man treats a woman in a decree given through the kingdom, and it's not the primary point of the author to be a complementarian or an egalitarian, but those issues are going to come up, and so by application, we'll talk about them. And I'll try to be very clear in what is principle and what is authorial intent to the original audience and what is application. Because if you walk away from the sermon going, well, Chris said this is what Esther was about, someone looks at you and goes, it's not about that. No, that was an application. And there are many applications to the principles here. So don't get confused and don't say one thing is an application and one thing is, we have to get it right. I will try to help you. Here's an application to this idea of the king being a big somebody and we being nobodies. And really, this is not, it's more principle because it's built into this book that those who are faithful, those who do what God has for them faithfully in the place God has put them, those are the ones whom God is pleased with. Be faithful where you are. You don't have to be a big somebody. No one is going to write a book that says, now, in the days of Chris Reiser, nobody, right? Because nobody cares. It's my goal to be faithful where the Lord has placed me. And no one's probably, there might be some impressive people in here, I don't know. Maybe history will record you one day. But most likely, no one's going to write a book with your name on it. Right? And yet you are to be faithful, working where God has placed you, and that's what matters. It isn't about being impressive. It's not about being the big somebody. It's about being the little nobody that knows the big God and serves him. Not just knows him, serves him. How many people in the houses I talk to say, I know God, I love God, and they haven't darkened the door of a church. They're not doing anything for anybody else. It's just for themselves. Not just saying you know God, but faithfully serving him. Esther and Mordecai, as we will see, were challenged to do just that, and they did. Next, the king's mighty power. So that's his impressive, prestigious identity. Now his mighty power. This is the king who ruled over the 127 provinces. and who sat on the royal throne, verse 2, which was in the citadel in Susa. Now, there's all kinds of historical challenges to this book, and if you read the commentaries, well, Herodotus, who, and there's like one copy of Herodotus from, you know, 1000 AD that then says, you know, everything Herodotus said was true. We got one copy. Got a lot more copies of the book of Esther that go back to 200 BC. And remember, it was written in 400 BC, so only 200 years, and all kinds of copies of the book of Esther. Whose history am I going to believe? Esther's over Herodotus, who got half the stuff wrong anyway. All right, Greek historian, kind of writing in his own perspective. Anyway, you can flesh that out yourself. But say, well, there's only 20. Herodotus says there's only 20 satrapies, not 127 provinces. Of course, the satrapies were like states, bigger areas of the province or of the country. The provinces were smaller designations, probably around cities. And of course, the author, in pumping Ahasuerus at the beginning, picks the smallest amount of administrative property, as it were. So he says, look, 127 provinces. That sounds better than 20 satrapies or 20 states, right? So he's picking the thing that will make him sound the greatest. They really, really were 127 provinces. And he uses that to show how great Ahasuerus is. All of this, so this vast territory from India to Ethiopia, and complete authority. He sits on his royal throne. That's meant to communicate something to you. He's the king. There are no other kings. And what he says goes. And that's it. Now, there was a sort of rule of law. But here's how the rule of law worked. The king, sitting on his throne, decided whatever he wanted. That got put into law. And then the king had to try to work his way through all the patchwork laws that King Darius had made before him and King Cyrus before him. And they had to try to arrange and jumble all those different kingly decrees as to what the law actually was. So the king would then find ways out from underneath the particular laws that other kings had made by making his own laws. It was a crazy patchwork quilt of lawfulness, which just simply was driven by whatever the king wanted. What the king wanted, he got, period. And everyone else had to do what he said. So just understand, we have a hard time understanding that because we live in a representative democracy, something like that. And yet, you know, sometimes our presidents try to act like kings. We get that. But we're just not used to that sort of thing. Guys, this was absolute power. Right? He could decide what he wanted. He could do what he wanted. Complete authority. I mean, he makes one decree that every single family in his entire realm had to obey. He sends it out, and that's law the next day. When they receive it, they have to do it, and he can kill them if they don't. I mean, those are the rules. So complete authority, vast territory. Third, the king's vast wealth and ego. Here we go. So what do you think this king is like? He's got all these, you know, got all this. All this authority, he's got all these riches. You think he's a nice guy? You think he's using his authority well? Answer, no. All right, king's vast wealth and ego. In the third year of his reign, he put all the rebellions down. He's about 35 years old, entering into the prime of his manhood, wanting to exercise all of the privileges of his royal estate from his territory to his harem. He's going to exercise it all. He's got everything you could ever want. And so what he does is he shows everyone how great he is. Now, you can do this in a couple of ways if you are an old-fashioned king who rules the world, which he pretty much did. You can show people how great you are by bringing your army and conquering them. Say, I'm great. I just conquered you, and now you serve me. And he did lots of that. He's actually planning. Again, we don't see from our text here. I think we certainly know from history that this really happened. He's going to take his army and try to conquer the Greeks. It's not going to go well. Just if you know your history, that doesn't go well. But nonetheless, that's what you do. So you show people you're great by conquering them, or you show people how great you are by inviting them to come to your city and showing them all of your wealth, opening up your treasuries. You see Old Testament kings that tried that, Israelite kings, it didn't go well. It's ego. It's always ego. Hey, come and see how great we are. You have people to your home. Look at my great home. Look at my perfectly cultured flowers. Right? Look at my new cow. So look at this backyard, this new barbecue grill I put in. Hey, it's fine to have that stuff. But don't have people over and just got accent. You put a little spotlight on it. Look at how great that is. Well, guys, by the way, you can try to do that. That's okay, I suppose. But you're going to get outdone by somebody next door. And they're going to put in the next barbecue, and it's going to be bigger than yours, and they're going to have a little outdoor thing with the fans on it. I want one of those. Well, King Ahasuerus has got you all beat. Don't try it. He's better than you. He's bigger than you. He's badder than you. He says, look, other people can have banquets. They can show how great they are. I'm going to have a 180-day banquet, a half year. My banquet's going to last for half a year, and I've got enough wealth to pull it off. Again, all the historians, you can't have a 180-day banquet. You can't? He did. Right? Did he have enough wealth to do that? Absolutely. He could keep this thing going for 180 days. He's probably rotating people in from all the provinces. Hey, you come in, and then you come in. You know how you just entertain the next delegation, and they come, send them back. He keeps probably the ones who are most important, because that's the second banquet we'll see in just a minute. So they all rotate through. He's probably also, because you look at this esteemed guest list, all right, he's got the army officers, verse 3, all the princes in attendance, the nobles and princes. He's probably got the army officers there because he's most likely using this opportunity to make the battle plans for conquering Greece. It takes a long time to travel, so he gets everybody in. He says, look how impressive I am. I want you to give me money, and I want you to give me troops so we can go take Greece. And look, I'm so powerful. How could you say no? And of course, we're going to win because look at all this incredible wealth that I have and this army. He had a standing army himself of about 10,000, just his personal bodyguard. He's going to impress everybody with all this stuff. So he brings them in for this 180-day banquet. It's real. It lasted 180 days. Well, I mean, who knows how many people came through? 20,000, 30,000, maybe more as they worked their way through. All their attendants, all the nobles, all of the army rulers. But look why he does this. This is why we say this is about his vast wealth and ego, because that's what the text tells us. The author of this book points to Ahasuerus' ego. It says, verse 4, he displayed the riches of his glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. His royal glory, his great majesty. Where do you hear those kinds of words? Where else in the Bible? You hear them for God himself. The author is clearly giving us an understanding that Ahasuerus thinks, what? I'm the top. I'm God. I'm the top. My splendor, my majesty. Remember when Nebuchadnezzar tried that? And God turned him in, you know, turned his mind into an ox, made him go insane? Well, by the way, we're going to see that things don't go so well for Ahasuerus either. A little different. But he is here to display these riches, his glory, his majesty. I mean, Psalm 45:3 says this. Gird your sword on your thigh, O mighty one, in your splendor and your majesty. And in your majesty, ride on victoriously for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness. Let your right hand teach you awesome things. Ahasuerus is here to say, it's my glory and my majesty. Now, before you get too hard on Ahasuerus, right? Unbelievers certainly, and unfortunately sometimes Christians, spend a lot of their time trying to get people to think they're impressive. Whether it's your gifts that you have, whether it's stuff that you can do, whether it's a relationship you have, look how impressive I am. And in fact, all unbelievers essentially spend their whole life saying, look how good I am, either with the impressive stuff I have or the cool stuff that I do or the sacrifice and service that I make. But it's all about them. Look at me. I'm great. We talked about world religions during this week, and all world religions are, look at me, look what I can do. I can earn my way to God. One way or the other, I can get there. I'm going to make it happen. There's only one religion that says you can't do that, and that's Christianity. That's it. Everything else is how impressive you are. And this morning, you might be here still trying to bang your own drum. You're going to have your 180-day banquet. Right? That's your whole life is a banquet about you. If that's true, without exception, you're not a Christian. Now, Christians fall into that, and maybe this was a you week. You know, you're going to do you. You're going to point everybody to you. I mean, do you really think the world says that by accident? No, they say that on purpose. It is all about you in their mind. Why would it be about anybody else? Well, it's all about Ahasuerus. And the author's pointing us to the reality of the world's arrogance, their boastfulness, their brash excess. Because this is extravagant excess. 180 days, come on. I mean, this is the biggest thing you could possibly have. The only reason is to say, I am great. And by the way, you are nothing. You can't have a 180-day banquet. You're all coming to my 180-day banquet because I told you that you had to come. Very interesting here, he can command the rulers and authorities to come, but there's going to be somebody that he can't command. We'll find out that in just a second. All right, well, that's so we'll work our way through the banquets here. 180-day banquet, number 2, is the 7-day banquet, because he's not done. All right, this is impressive. It's like the Ahasuerus convention. All right, for 180 days, they just keep on coming. It puts up the banners, look how great I am. Well, then he says, we're pulling out all the stops. You thought that was big? He probably, again, saved the best for last. It says in verse 5, when the days were completed, those 180 days, the king gave a banquet. This is another banquet. There are two, not just one. There are two, 180 days, just kind of the preliminary banquet. You get to eat and drink and come and enjoy the food, you know, walk through the stalls and, you know, see all the stuff that's there. But here's the big one. He gave a banquet lasting 7 days, verse 5, for all the people who were present in the citadel in Susa, from the greatest to the least in the court of the garden of the king's palace. Now, it doesn't mean he went out and got people from the highways and byways, the least being the poor people in town. No way. That means the greatest to the least of the rulers who were there. So everybody who had some kind of position, every noble, every army officer, they got treated to this final pull out the stops, massive 7-day banquet of absolute pleasure. Again, you have the esteemed guests who were there, all those who were in charge in the kingdom, from the greatest to the least, who are all, of course, below Ahasuerus. And now notice in verse 6, again, when you read the Old Testament, remember that authors choose what they're going to tell you. Right? All these things about Ahasuerus, he could have told us anything else. He could have introduced Ahasuerus a totally different way. He introduces him this way. And then verse 6 is like over the top, describing. It's supposed to overwhelm our senses with the greatness of this banquet. Read verse 6. There were hangings of fine white and violet linen, held by cords of fine purple linen, on silver rings and marble columns. So you have riches upon riches upon riches, velvet upon linen upon silver. Is it just piling up? And this is real. It actually happened. But that's how impressive this was. Couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. You walk into this courtyard, and there's all these hangings. And it's everywhere you look, as you look to the hangings and what they're hanging on, that's more impressive. And what they're on, that's more impressive than what people are sitting on, silver and gold couches. But not only what they're sitting on, but what the couches are sitting on. The very pavement is full of precious stones and jewels that would just shine in the sun. And the king is sitting there going, I am great. Come and see how great I am. He's just pouring it on. But that's not the best part. Like, what? No. Because all that's impressive, but there's one thing, and remember, this is only men at this banquet, but it would be true whether it's men or women. There's one thing that everybody's waiting for at a party. And if you've been in the world much, and if you go out to dinner parties, and if you, you know, for unbelievers, and if you have your business lunches, everybody's waiting for one thing, the alcohol. And I'm not wrong, if you talk to anybody here, if you're at a college party, the party doesn't start till what? Out comes the alcohol. Hey, anybody can have a party, but it doesn't get going for unbelievers until the alcohol flows. And this did. The king knows that. They're big into alcohol, of course. And so drinks were served, verse 7, in golden vessels of various kinds. The royal wine was plentiful according to the king's bounty. I mean, he's this rich. Imagine how much wine. Literally, the streets are flowing with wine. Now, I do want to make an application here. Be careful. Yes, we have liberty as believers to drink but not get drunk, right? We understand that. Understand, however, that again, the primary focus of worldly pleasure boils itself down in nearly every case when it comes to these things to alcohol. If believers are participating in places where the whole focus or where the end focus becomes alcohol, I wonder if that's really your liberty. Be careful there. You can't have fun without the beer coming out. If nobody will come to your party unless you got alcohol there, I'm not sure you're exercising your liberty. I think you're being worldly. You're going to have to be really careful there. Right? Now, you have to walk your way through that. I just said a lot in one single sentence, but I want you to carefully think about it. Because the world says, hey, it's all about the alcohol, because that's what loosens us up. That's what gets us going. And it did here, believe me. And it wasn't good. It never is. Never is. Drinks were served. The drinking, it was so all-consuming, this drinking. The drinking was done, verse 8, according to the law. There was no compulsion, for so the king had given orders to each official of his household that he should do according to the desires of each person. Probably what that means is this. It almost sounds like nobody had to drink. That's not what this means. Right? There were probably some rules in various, you know, court. When you would go into the court, the Persians had rules. When the king drank, you got to drink. You know, it's like you go to a wedding, you watch and see what the head table does. And you get, well, what the king said is, look, rules are off. I'm going to make a rule. This is bureaucracy. I'm going to make a rule that there are no rules. Right? Rule number one is there are no rules. And there are no rules about drinking. You don't have to wait for me. You have to wait for anybody. You drink as much as you want, whenever you want, however you want, and you do that for 7 days. Open bar 7 days, the biggest kegger ever. Bigger than your college party, bigger than your frat deal, biggest thing you've ever been to. It's flowing out there, all different kinds, and it just gets more and more and more. And even if it started out somewhat diluted, which it might have, by the time you're at 7 days, it doesn't matter how diluted that wine is, it's in your system. There's a bunch of men, 15,000, 20,000 men, partaking over 7 days when they're told there's no law and there's no rule. There was no law and there was no rule. And by the time you end up with 7 days, there's literally no law and no rule. So they're drinking, and they are making their decisions now based upon the strength that has begun to fill them. And by the way, this very opulence. So I want you to understand that in the book of Esther, there's all kinds of reversals. So here's the reversal alert. This is the best this king will ever look. Right here, he's reached his pinnacle when it comes to our understanding of him. Okay, the massive party, the drinking that's going on. But by the way, all the different kinds of goblets are described. You can get big drinks, little drinks, massive bowl, little thing, silver, gold, different kinds of different shapes. It's all about what's inside, of course. And all his fascinating, luxurious couches and his massive kingdom. But he's reached the zenith of his career when it comes to this book. There's going to be a reversal. It's not going to go well. Right? He's going to get shown up by the great God of the universe, even though the God of the universe is not even mentioned. That's the irony of this book. The author is pointing towards that all the way along. Look how impressive he is, and yet he can't control his destiny. Someone else does. And we'll walk our way through that. Guys, do not be impressed by the opulence of the world. There are no thousand-year kingdoms. There is only the eternal church of God, the people of God. Psalm 2, why are the nations in an uproar? The peoples devising a vain thing. The kings of the earth take their stand like Ahasuerus. The rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us tear their fetters apart, cast their cords away from us. He who sits in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. He will speak to them in his anger, terrify them in his fury, saying, but as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. God is not impressed. And unfortunately, we are too often. No need to be impressed. Your God is great, and you serve him. You don't need this. Ahasuerus needed it. It's fascinating that not only is God not mentioned on the side of Esther and Mordecai, but God, a mocking of God, is not mentioned here, but it's clearly implied. If you look in the book of Daniel, you find that the kings got the stuff out of their, you know, some of these royal things that are here are probably still from the sanctuary in Jerusalem. But that's not mentioned here because, again, that's not the author's intent. He's pointing to that subtly. When Nebuchadnezzar got those things out and when Belteshazzar got those things out, he said, in the face of God. I guarantee you Ahasuerus is doing the same thing. In the face of God. But it's just not mentioned. The author isn't mentioning it to us, and he's not mentioning it on either side. All right. So that's the zenith of the king. Now this little incident takes place. So kind of as an aside, verse 9, Queen Vashti also gave a banquet. Oh, now comes the queen. Notice how short a description she gets. The king, Queen Vashti, also gave a banquet for the women in the palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So even Vashti's mention is in light of the greatness of the king. The woman, in this case, gets very little press and very little time. But that's part of the irony of this book, because the woman is going to get a lot of time. And God uses faithful women, as we will see. Not that Vashti was a faithful woman. That's one that we won't go there. But nonetheless, already we are about to see a reversal. She's just casually mentioned. Oh, yeah. And it's probably, he's in the courtyard, she's in the backside of the palace. Now, this, as nearly as we can tell historically, is not normal. They didn't normally have segregated banquets. Normally, the king would have his queen. She would be there. The nobles would have their wives. So maybe it's because of the kind of drinking that was going on that they separated them out. Who knows? But this would most likely be unusual. So it's mentioned, hey, she's having her own party in the back, but that's nothing. Here's the big party. And now the king is going to make a fateful decision. The king's impulsive demand. We're just going to be able to get, I'm going to get you to the mic drop here. All right, we're going to get to the kind of the crux of this chapter. Drop the mic and move on because we don't have time this morning. But this demand that he's about to make is made in poor timing. So number one, they're poor timing. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, this dude's been drinking for 7 days. Right now, heart being merry with wine does not always mean inebriation. It's used in the book of Ruth where there is wine at Boaz's final celebration for the harvest. And I don't think the indication there is that he was inebriated, simply that he enjoyed the celebration that they had and laid down to rest. And that's when Ruth comes and they work their way through the marriage proposal. But in this case, I think it's very clearly meant to point to the fact that he's had too much wine for several reasons. One, he makes a really poor decision. He responds really stupidly, really foolishly, which people do when they're inebriated, right? And he gets angry really fast. Alcohol and anger go together. And if you grew up with an alcoholic father or mother, or you have an alcoholic spouse, you know this is how this goes. It's ugly. When the inhibitions come off, anger comes out, and that will be true for this king. He doesn't control his anger well anyway, and when you get lubricated up with a little bit of alcohol, the anger comes. It's ugly. It's evil. Some of you have experienced it. It's not pretty, and that's what happens here, because this is ugly. The stuff he's about to do here, it's not some cool king, and the author is purposely going to show us that. he gets stupid and he gets angry because he made this bad decision to start with. So poor timing. Don't make decisions after you've had 7 days of a drinking party. Don't have a drinking party, okay? We get that, all right? But don't make foolish decisions, all right? Don't make decisions when this is... And interesting little piece of history. There's one historian that said they did this on purpose. They would get inebriated because they felt like they were closer to the gods when they were drunk, because you feel all loosened up, right? You feel like you are a superhuman if this has ever happened to you. Actually, you are less, almost less than human, but you feel like you're superhuman. They felt like that, and they would make decisions about war while they were inebriated, and then someone would record that, and they would decide the next day or the next week when they got sober if they should do that. Was that actually a good decision? Fascinating. That might be what's going on here. But nonetheless, so he gets inebriated, but he makes a different kind of decision. So it pops into his head, as it does when you're drunk. I'm going to do something really impressive. And he commanded, so poor timing, firm command. He commanded his eunuchs, which in this case probably means those who have been physically rendered unable to be physically intimate with women. Why? Because they're in charge of the harem. And the king didn't let anybody mess with his harem. If you had children being produced by your officials, then they would come for the throne. So you didn't let that happen. So if they were going to be involved with the women, you made sure that they couldn't have offspring. And that's the idea. These seven eunuchs, they would have been close to the king, his trusted advisors. He sends Mehum, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abgtha, Zethar, and Carcass. And it's probably a big pronouncement. These seven eunuchs are going to get the queen. Again, this is what you do when you just are not thinking wisely. All right? She's going to go. We're going to make a big pronouncement. They're probably putting those big, you know, divan chairs on their shoulders. They're going to walk off and go get the queen, and they're going to bring her back in. Well, why? Why would he do this? This is a firm command. He gives it to the eunuchs. He says, bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown. Well, why? Look back into your text. Why is he going to do this? Again, the author is so clear. Right? In order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. She was stunning. The king wouldn't have anyone that wasn't stunning, because that showed his power and how good he was. See, this has been true down throughout the ages. Men looking for women who are pretty so that they can show themselves off. The woman becomes a trophy for their own ego, and this happens over and over and over. Application here, be careful, young ladies, of men who will come and flatter you for your beauty. You may be very beautiful. They will flatter you for that so they can get you as their trophy. They will put you up in front of everybody else, and they will treat you like dirt everywhere else because you're just a trophy to them. You're just another thing to have. I wish I could say that no Christian man ever does that. It's not true. They do, unfortunately. Mostly it's unbelievers who masquerade as Christians who come and find women, beautiful or not, and they flatter them so they can be their trophy. Guys, this is what the world does. This is the nature of male-female relationship, unfortunately, in the vast majority of cases for pagans, is that it's all about who's got the better looking or the better, more successful person, and then that becomes a trophy for you. That's all Vashti is for Ahasuerus. It's very clear. And he's going to parade her around. Some of the historians said because she's bringing her crown, maybe she was going to, you know, not be clothed. I don't think that's the issue. I think she's going to come with her crown on, in all her royal splendor. He's going to go, that's mine. See that? And see, here's where it really gets big, because you can drink all you want and you can have all the cool couches and all the cool stuff, but it's physical intimacy, it's sexual pleasure that the vast majority of men are living for. That's the top. And that's what he's living for. He's got his harem, you know, hundreds and hundreds of women that he can go and be with at any given time that was given to the kings to show how great they were. They could have their pleasure at any time. That's the height, man. In most worldly circles, that's it. Sexuality rules the day. Just consider our world, and you will find that I am right. And that's the way it's always been. So he's going to show off his queen, how great she is, and the power that he has. She's so beautiful, and she's mine. And he's going to show everybody else, a woman used as a prop for a man's ego. Now, women, you're not off the hook. Because unfortunately, so often what happens is that your own ego and your own vanity is drawn by that man who will flatter you, and your ego steps in and you go, I'll take that. You blind yourself to the other things that are there. I'll take that because I love the attention. I love to be told what I look like. In fact, I love what I look like. I love that I am beautiful, and I'm going to use that to build up my own ego. Never is beauty used for that reason. I'm going to build my own ego. And so women, you're not off the hook. You fall easily for this when you are hooked on yourself. Men seeking women who are hooked on themselves and using them, and them using each other, because the woman uses the man as well. because it's ugly. That's most male-female relationship apart from Christ. It should never happen in the church, ever. It does. It shouldn't. Here's the mic drop, though, because we need to move towards the conclusion, just for today. We're not done. So, guys, everything is built to the point where this guy gets everything he wants, anytime he wants, displays himself in any way that he wants. So what's going to happen here? And we can already see the end of the story. She's going to say, okay, he's going to parade her in. She's going to, you know, do a couple pirouettes. He's going to say, look how great my queen is. She's stunning. Look how great I am. She's going to go out. They're going to finish their party and head off to conquer Greece. Oh, but here comes the reversal. Here comes the irony in the historical narrative. So I'll leave you with this. Here we go. So he tells him to go do this. And then just a little teeny phrase at the end, right? Or verse 12. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuch. She flat turns him down. Nope, I'm not going to come to be an ornament at your drunken orgy. It's not happening. I will not show up and be displayed in that way. Now, here's the things you're going to have to figure out this week. Is she a hero, a strong woman who stands up to a weak man? Is she kind of pathetic in that she refuses to follow, you know, to follow what she, the instruction that she's been given? We're going to walk our way through this because the king is going to be making determinations from this. He's going to be determining how we ought to respond to her flat refusal, and we're going to have to work our way through this. But the bottom line, from the author's point of view, is not complementarianism versus egalitarianism. We'll talk about some of those things. The whole thing here is the king thought he was great. The king thought he could get what he wants, and his own queen says, forget it, in your face. You can't control me. Now, could he have forced her to come? Sure. Does he? No. It's fascinating. It's fascinating. He will not force. He will not stoop to forcing her to come. She's just supposed to come because he's a king and he's in charge. And a lot of you guys, not just guys, but guys and girls, when we think about what the world should have for us, that's the way we think it is. I'm the king. Why doesn't everything happen my way? People should just come. Just do what I want. And they don't, because you cannot control your own life. You kind of control one single event of it, actually. God's in control of all of it. And here we see God's at work. Now, I'm not saying Vashti was a wonderful Christian woman, but God is at work in the circumstances of these pagan people doing pagan things to bring about the salvation of his people, and he is not thwarted. And Ahasuerus is not in charge. By the way, neither is Vashti. She's not in charge either. So how are we working towards communion with all that? You're like, whoa, where are we going? Here's the thought. Guys, the world portrays itself as great, powerful, mighty, awesome. We serve a king and a lord and a God who is great and mighty and awesome. But what did he do? When he came, he displayed himself as lowly, as a servant. He veiled his glory and he walked among us as a servant and he died for us. And that's what we celebrate. The king who died, that makes him great. Not the king who had his 100-day banquet only, partied only, showed off his trophies only. God had the right to do all of that. He came and he died for us. And we celebrate the fact that we are little and he is great. And we run to him because we are nothing and we have no ability to save ourselves, no ability to do what is necessary to be in right relationship with him. He did everything. It ought to humble us to the core. And so if the men who are going to do communion would come and just stand at the front, we're going to sing a song before we do this. So if the men are going to serve, just come and stand at the front. If everyone else will stand, we're going to have our music team come and they're going to lead us. I hope this will just help focus your mind not on the world and not on yourself, but on Christ, because that's why we're here this morning, to take communion. Christ and what he's done. So yeah, let's stand and let's sing.